Hello and welcome to the Guelph Politicast. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico. If this is your first time streaming or downloading the program, Guelph Politicast is an interview show where I talk to politicians, activists, and people of note making a difference or are just trying to make life in the Royal City more interesting. For previous episodes of the Guelph Politicast, you can find them on the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean, or you can subscribe through iTunes. Today, I again let someone else do the talking. Last Thursday, Timmins James Bay MP Charlie Angus was in Guelph raising funds, awareness, and excitement about his leadership bid for the federal New Democratic Party. Angus is one of five federal politicians running so far, and the second one to visit Guelph in the last month or so. Federal politics and appealing to Guelph's progressives is the topic of this week's Guelph Politicast. Charlie Angus does not have what you might call a typical politician's resume. He was born in Timmins but made his way to Toronto, where he co-founded a punk band called L'Étranger with his friend Andrew Cash. How they would both end up in the House of Commons at the same time is unknown, but Angus's path took him from Toronto clubs and the early days of Much Music to being a community activist and establishing a Catholic worker house and a homeless shelter for men. He ended up returning to Northern Ontario, where he fought for social justice and founded a magazine devoted to life and culture in his own backyard, and was recognized for his contributions and came to the attention of Jack Layton and the NDP in 2004. He ran to be the MP for Timmins James Bay that year and won by a mere 600 votes. The rest, as they say, is history. Angus has become a well-known figure in the NDP caucus due to his tireless advocacy on Indigenous issues. The Billy Good Reserve of Attawapiskat is in his riding, and during the Idle No More movement, Angus's voice was one of the loudest on behalf of First Nations in Parliament. In this Parliament, he continues to hold the government to account as Indigenous and Northern Affairs a critic, a role he had to give up in order to run for the NDP leadership. But Angus is still fighting for Indigenous rights. His latest book, Children of the Broken Treaty, Canada's Lost Promise and One Girl's Dream, is now available in paperback, and you'll hear a portion of it in this week's Politicast. You'll also hear Angus talk about how you can't have environmental justice without economic justice, how Canada has to do more to fight inequality, and how the NDP has to prove that they are more than just policy wonks and get back to inspiring people. So here's Charlie Angus as recorded last Thursday at the Bookshelf Green Room.
Thank you for coming, and as I said, I thought I was speaking in a bookstore, so I had it in my head I was doing book readings this morning, not talking politics. So I might start with a book reading, but it might explain how I perceive politics. In my quest to become leader of the Federal New Democratic Party, I'm looking to see if it's possible to have a conversation about politics that moves us away from the message box, the spin cycle, the short-term hits that, you know, Eric Grenier on CBC will say, well, they got 2 points off this, and it, you know, this endless polling, that to me is a real, there's an overall debasement of political life that gave us Donald Trump. And we all, I think the progressive class certainly bears its level of responsibility. We can blame the crazy alt-right, but there is a level of responsibility of the so-called progressive class who did think they were too smart to waste time talking to people in Wisconsin and Michigan and Ohio, because they believed that they could speak for those people and they knew what those people were thinking and they weren't talking to them. So is it possible to have politics that brings us back to kind of a conversation of where we need to be as a nation? Who are we? Where do we need to go? The general big principles. And then can we actually then build a platform that starts to speak to some of the inequities, the disconnect between how Ottawa, sunny ways, has this image of Canada that is being perpetuated in very carefully created images, and the reality of what ordinary people are, to reconnect ordinary people to politics, to make them believe that it should be an honorable profession, to believe that politicians should actually follow through on the things they say. So this is the direction I'm going in. I'm a storyteller. I always brag that I never read a piece of policy. It's not that I don't believe that policy is important, but I sometimes think as New Democrats, we're obsessed with policy, and we believe that if there's just one more policy plank, we will win people over. But it's not about that. It's about building a relationship. Politics should be about building a way of talking with people, of building trust, hearing what their values are, and reconnecting with them. So that's generally where I come from. So I'm gonna start with a reading from my latest book, Children of the Broken Treaty. And I started this book after I was given a copy of Clearing the Plains by James Dashuk, who is also from Timmins. And this book, I found this book was mailed to me by University of Regina Press, and they said, you should read this. And Clearing the Plains blew my mind, because we were never taught any of this history. But what I read in Clearing the Plains was the pattern, the deliberate pattern of the extinction of the Indian people that was so clear. And why it resonated with me is that that pattern is the same pattern today in 2017. For all the reconciliation hashtag stuff coming out for government, the system that Duncan Campbell Scott built was alive and well. They've just changed a few of the words. They put some nicer faces on it, but the system is still there. And I saw what I was dealing with in Attawapiskat and Keshechewan Treaty 9. I saw Clearing the Plains. And I contacted the publisher and I said, I would like to write part two, which is how this ties into this story. So this is generally the story of Shannon Kustashian, who was an extraordinary, extraordinary young woman who just wanted to go to school, never been in a real school. And Shannon was in grade 8 when she started to launch a campaign that has, I think, transformed the conversation of Indigenous inequity in this country. And I think it's a powerful metaphor and story because it's the first time where an Indigenous youth is able to confront face-to-face the power structure. And I think that the moment when Shannon confronts the federal government on Parliament Hill was a transformative moment. And what I did in telling this story is, how did we get here? So this is the story of Shannon, but this is the story of the treaty. This is the story of the residential schools. And it is the story of the children who are dying every day in northern Canada. These are not isolated incidents. They fall into a very clear and understandable pattern. So I attempted in this book to lay the pattern out through the suicide crisis, through what happened at St. Anne's Residential School, through Shannon's struggle to get young people engaged in transforming our nation. So I'm going to read the intro and then we'll get into a conversation. So the opening line is from 14-year-old Chelsea Edwards of Attawapiskat First Nation. Perhaps you heard the story of how Rosa Parks helped start the civil rights movement. Well, we are the children who've been sitting at the back of the school bus our whole lives, and we don't want to stay there anymore. Ten-year-old Hazen is telling the story in front of 600 students at Boxwood Public School in Markham, Ontario. She's nervous, and she fiddles with her PowerPoint presentation. A first-generation Muslim Canadian, Hazen has never done anything like this before. She isn't the type of girl who's comfortable standing out in a crowd, but the issue is important, and she wants to do it justice. So she pulls herself together and tells the story the way it should be told, the way Shannon would tell the story. And this is how the story goes. Shannon Kustashian was a girl from the Cree First Nation who lived in a very poor community called Attawapiskat, and she'd never seen a real school. The children were being educated in broken down portables on a toxic site, and some of them were getting sick and losing hope. And for years they had waited for the government to follow through on a promise to build a proper school, but nothing ever changed. And then one day a government minister told the children they weren't going to school at all. The children were heartbroken, but not Shannon. She said that what was happening to them was wrong. She told her classmates that education is a human right. School is a time for hopes and dreams for the future, Shannon said. Every kid deserves this. And Shannon and her friends went to Ottawa to challenge the government, and they reached out to students across Canada. And the students formed clubs, and they wrote letters to the Prime Minister, and they held rallies. The fight for a school in Attawapiskat became the largest youth-driven rights movement in Canadian history. Shannon had to leave home when she was 13 in order to get the kind of education that wasn't available on her reserve. And she was homesick having to leave her family and culture. But she dreamed of being a lawyer to help her people. Unfortunately, she died in a car accident while living far from home. But the story doesn't end there. Other students came forward to carry on her work. And thus was born Shannon's dream, the campaign to fight for equal education rights for every Indigenous child in this country. And Hasna looks up. The students are spellbound. Like her, most of them are first-generation Canadians. Their notion of Canada is a country built on fairness. This confidence in the national character of inclusion is manifest in their school, a bright and open building where children are encouraged to become whatever they dream. Shannon would call this a comfy school. But now they've heard the story, they learn there's another Canada where children are being denied rights. These students don't know much about the treaty that was signed by the government and Shannon's people, but they do understand the meaning of a broken promise. And so the story tells them that their children are the broken promise who are like them. And that if this, the transformative part, Shannon said if the young people stood together, they could make a difference. They could make Canada a fairer place. And this is why Hasna is so excited and has worked up the nerve to bring the story to a gymnasium full of youngsters. We can be part of this change, she tells the students. This story of a young Cree leader who fought for education rights in Canada has been told in video, novel, textbooks, a full-length documentary film premiered at the Toronto International Film Festival. DC Comics used the story of Shannon Kustashian as inspiration for the latest member of the Justice League. In the comic, a young James Bay student draws on the traditional strengths of her people to be transformed into the hero Equinox, taking her place alongside iconic figures as Superman, the Green Lantern, and Wonder Woman. In 2012, on the 600th anniversary of the birth of Joan of Arc, CBC host George Strombolopoulos placed Shannon Kustashian at the top of a list of five teenage girls who kicked ass in history. He named her alongside Joan of Arc, Mary Shelley, Anne Frank, and Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And the newly opened Canadian Museum of Human Rights features Shannon and her campaign. In 2012, the House of Commons unanimously passed Shannon's Dream parliamentary motion, calling on the Government of Canada to close the funding gap faced by First Nations students and to establish quality First Nations education. This motion has become a historic benchmark in the fight for Indigenous child equity. The ongoing fascination with a girl from an impoverished reserve is even more striking because her public career was a scant 2 years, stretching from the time when Shannon challenged a minister of the Crown at the age 13 to her death in a highway accident just before her 16th birthday. It's all in all quite an impact for a girl who just wanted what every other child in Canada takes for granted, the chance to go to school. This book is about two places. It's about James Bay and it's about Ottawa. It's about the people who stood up to inequity and paved the way for a young leader like Shannon Kustashian. But it's also the story of those who were empowered to make a difference but chose not to. Among them were a comparatively small number of powerful people who showed a criminal disregard for the welfare of their citizens and failed their responsibilities to safeguard the Canadian people's treaties. These key people were aided and abetted by many people working in bureaucracies, agencies, and the church orders who opted to serve the narrow interests of their organization above their obligation to do right. And that isn't to say there haven't been well-meaning people in these positions of responsibility. Over the decades, officials have commissioned countless reports on the state of education, child health, clean water, and so on. And the various government departments dealing with Indigenous issues have been subject to oversight by parliamentary hearings and investigations by the Auditor General. And the best bureaucratic minds were questioned and asked for explanations. But the unwillingness of these empowered persons to take responsibility has left too many children in needless deprivation. And that is why the story of Shannon Kustashian has such power. She cut through this bureaucratic fog. She spoke with the directness and urgency of a child. She called on the government to stop hiding behind departmental missives and policy prevarications and start being accountable as adults and parents. She asked them to explain why they failed to protect the children. Which brings me back to Boxwood Public School. As I stand up to speak to the gymnasium of youngsters, a student puts up her hand and says, "Did you really know Shannon?" "Yes, I knew Shannon. Not a day goes by that I don't think of her. My thoughts remain a muddle of emotions and regret. But what I remember most is a young girl with a big heart who had a hell of a lot of moxie." But the answer I give is simple and affirmative. Shannon was just like you. She would be so proud to see you standing up to make change. These students don't know about the ins and outs of what has gone wrong with Canada's relationship with Indigenous people. They just know that the children deserve better. And this is perhaps the power of the story. It offers us a resolution to just do what is right by the children. If I were to sum up the purpose of this book or explain its political agenda, it would be to underline the urgency of this imperative. Put simply, Canada cannot afford to squander the potential of another generation of First Nation children. So I launched my leadership campaign on the 5th anniversary of the passing of Shannon's dream motion in the House of Commons. Every single member of the House of Commons stood up and said that they would end the inequity, and the inequity continues. We passed Jordan's principle through the House to end the medical denials to children, and it continued. The lack of political will to change has got to stop. This is the issue for our generation, our historic obligation to fix the damage and the destruction that has been done to a people. And goodwill and good talk from government ain't going to change it. The system has to be fundamentally dismantled and replaced. If I said that with any more urgency, I don't think I could. It's what I've learned seeing the institution. It's not that there's not good people there, but the unwillingness of the federal government to come to terms with what this system has got, we have to take that on. And I see it at the grassroots level, I see it in ordinary Canadians are moving forward, but one of the reasons I'm running for leader is that we have to deal with this inequity, and we have to deal with it once and for all. I'm going to just give you a couple of quick outlines of where I'm going, and then we can talk. I've been on 5 provinces this month, and I am absolutely idealistically in love with this nation. I love Canada. To me, every part of Canada is an adventure. I love the beauty of the land. I love the immensity of it. And I love the people and our openness to do good things. And we are a great nation, but we could be better. And it's not good enough to look over the border and say, well, you know, at least we're not like the crazy Americans. That is like the lamest attitude I think you could ever have. And we have to stop being arrogant and smug about that, because the inequities that are starting, that have fissured across America, are fissuring across our nation as we speak. And we have to learn from that. So I was on Vancouver Island, which is an incredibly, it's just a magical place. And I learned so much there. You know, we went up to Cumberland in the Comox Valley, an old coal mining town. I'm a sucker for mining towns, and we saw Ginger Goodwin's grave, who was a labor organizer who was literally hunted down and murdered for defending the coal miners there. And I wanted to see his grave, so we went there, and then they said to me, you got to see the Japanese graves. And there was an entire community in Cumberland, and during the war, they were all arrested and taken away, and people kicked their gravestones all over the fields. And after the war, they came back and they rebuilt this beautiful monument of the old gravestones. And that the money to rebuild those gravestones, there's a little plaque. And one of the unions that donated money are the nickel miners from Sudbury. And I thought, that's who our nation is. And I thought, can you imagine that union meeting in Sudbury where they voted to get money to fix a Japanese graveyard 2,000 kilometers away? That's what solidarity is. And they tell us that it's all, you know, dog eat dog, look out for yourself. That's not the real Canada. We can do immense good things. And that little graveyard in Comox taught me so much. And as we were driving down the coast, we passed these logging trucks. Like every 5 minutes, there's a logging truck. And they got big trees in BC. These are very rich loads of lumber. And I asked the guy, I said, so where are the sawmills? And he said, we don't have sawmills anymore. They shut down every sawmill on Vancouver Island. Thousands of men out of work. Communities that were once thriving are deteriorating, and the logs are still coming out of the ground. And they're being shipped raw to China for processing. And this also is the story of Canada, that we have such immense resources that we allow so much of it to be squandered. And, you know, Canada has not gotten to terms with itself that we are an extractive economy. Taking stuff from the ground is what's driven Canada for the last 150 years. And there's always a belief that there'll be another strike, another discovery. But the idea that we take logs out of the ground and ship them raw to be processed somewhere else while leaving thousands of people unemployed in our own region is the story of the regions of our country today. And that's the power of what capitalism is doing. And so then when you ask yourself, well, where are the unemployed workers going? Well, they catch a WestJet flight to Fort Mac and live in the bush camps. And that's the story of Canada. You know, Fort Mac is not in isolation. Fort Mac is the symbol as well of what is happening, where people are leaving rural New Brunswick. They're leaving rural Quebec. They leave Northern Ontario. They leave 2 and sometimes 3 weeks at a time for this economy that takes but does not put back. I am convinced that we are not going to get environmental justice in this nation without economic justice. We cannot separate these two. We cannot simply say we're going to meet our international obligations without a plan, and that plan has to include not leaving people behind. We can do this, but we have to bring people to the table. We have international obligations to meet our greenhouse gas emissions, and everybody knows in Canada, in Ottawa, that there's no intention of meeting them. They've never had any intention of meeting them, but they figure if they say nice things, somehow the environment will get better. Well, it's not. And we've run out of road. And just down the road from where I live in Northern Ontario, I live in a little mining town of Cobalt. My most beautiful place on the planet is about 5 minutes from my house. And it's this lake, and it's this incredible lake. And in this lake, you know, the trumpeter swans are back, you know? Trumpeter swans were extinct. They're back. And the blue herons come, and you sometimes see wolves. And, you know, nature has an incredible power to rebound. And you see that in the mining town. This has had the environment kicked out of it. But you can't swim in this lake, and you can't fish in this lake. Because 100 years ago, it was considered perfectly acceptable to take all the heavy metals and toxins and dump them in water, because it was cheap and easy. And what ended that? Well, legislation ended that. It wasn't that companies decided to find a market-based solution to a market-caused problem. They were forced to clean up. And once they started to clean up the waters, things started to recover. And I believe that in terms of our obligations internationally, we need to establish the legislation that's hard limits. We are going to meet our greenhouse gas commitments because these are the limits, and you're going to have to meet them. And that isn't going to be that surprising for industry, because when I talk to industry, I think they've been waiting for this for a long time. They just can't believe the government are such pushovers on this. But it means we'll work with industry. I don't have a problem working with industry. We will meet these targets. And what we need to do is start the reinvestments now in the new economy. The number one place in the world for solar potential is Southern Alberta. I mean, Germany is moving ahead at a dramatic pace. The top solar sites in Germany don't even come close to the worst sites in Southern Alberta. And you talk to energy workers in Alberta and they say, where's the federal government? Justin Trudeau is not making any of these investments. So he's approved 3 pipelines, he's got the 4th, and we've got a 5th coming. But there's no commitments to build this new economy. And you talk to people in Calgary and they're saying, listen, we're in the downturn, this is now the time for the transition, but it's not happening. So this is what the vision needs to look like. We need to say, we're going to start to build this new economy. We're going to reestablish some regional abilities for communities to have balance. Economies are like ecosystems. You know, what we've had with this government and the last government, the Chrétien government and the Martin government, is this belief of trickle-down economics, that if you look after those at the top of the economic food chain, everyone else is going to do fine. Well, they're not. We've seen the complete disappearance of the middle class over the last 30 years. When Justin Trudeau speaks in the House, he never mentions anything without saying middle class. I always say if it was a university drinking game, people would be hammered after 5 minutes of a Trudeau speech. And it's always the middle class and those wanting to join them. to me, is a really insidious line. If you listen, I'm not making this up. Listen, he always says the middle class and those wanting to join them. It's this aspirational thing. Like, if you just work a little harder, you get to be with us winners. But my dad joined the middle class when he was 40. Because my parents were the children of miners. They didn't get to go to university. They quit school, my mom at 15, my dad at 16. And my dad was so good in mathematics, the math department teachers took him aside and said, John, you're so good in math, it's time to quit school and get a job. Because he was going to go underground otherwise, and they got him a job on surface. And when my dad was 40, he had enough money saved to go back to school. That was always his dream, and he became a college professor in economics at 40. And that was the middle class. The belief that if you invested in education, you could get something for it. And our family moved to a little house in Toronto, and my mom worked 5 days a week as a secretary, and she worked Sundays in a restaurant to pay for that house, but you could afford that house. And everyone that I knew, dads and moms, worked. And all the factories that lined Scarborough when we moved to Scarborough, or in the white-collar jobs that served those jobs are all gone. They were all traded away a long time ago in our great vision for trade. But at that time, anyone in my generation could pay for a university education with a summer job. That middle class has been undermined and destroyed by deliberate policy. So when the federal government and the Liberal government are talking about the middle class, they're perpetuating a fiction that doesn't exist anymore. And what we have now is a new working class. That new working class is white collar and blue collar. It's students being told, you have to accumulate $60,000 worth of debt in order to participate as a productive member in our economy, and what we're going to give you is the so-called gig economy, you know, short-term contracts, no pensions, the chance of a permanent future, it's not in your, don't even dream about it. And you can't even buy a house or live in the neighborhoods and cities that you love. And our finance minister says, suck it up, that's the new normal. No, this is the result of the kind of policies that have favored that 1% year after year, and it's going to be up to us to say we have to reestablish an equilibrium, some fairness for this generation, and to reestablish some balance in the economy. And that is going to be my focus. But the third issue, and I started out with this, we don't get environmental justice without economic justice, but we don't get either without Indigenous First Nation justice. The days when the wealth comes off the territory, where people are put in basically in Treaty 9 internal displacement camps without any ability to make decisions about the future of their territory, their communities, even how health dollars are being spent, that's got to end. Treaty 9 was signed in James Bay, in Northern Ontario, 1905, 1906, with the province of Ontario and the federal government, and Duncan Campbell Scott was the treaty signer. That treaty transformed Ontario from an economic backwater into the economic powerhouse it is today. Treaty 9 gave Ontario access to massive hydro wealth, massive gold, mineral, logging, you name it. All that wealth was transferred to Queen's Park in Ottawa, and the communities were left in destitution. So, reconciliation is not a hashtag. This is about making the nation that we should have been all along, a nation that is inclusive. And it is also smart economic sense. When you empower young people, when you give them education, when you give them the tools to become part of the economy, our nation will be transformed by that. That is why I'm running. Because these are not issues that I believe we can put off with, you know, nice language anymore. We have to start making this a reality, and we have to commit to it now, because we can't let this thing go on any longer the way it's gone on, because we're squandering too much of our resources, we're squandering our environment, we're allowing our regions to start to atrophy, and this young generation of Indigenous youth will transform this country in a way that we have no ability to even imagine, but it's going to be fantastic for me to watch it happen. And there are, in every little community, there's a Shannon out there. And they shouldn't have to fight for school. They should know whatever their dreams are going to be met. And we will be blessed to see it happen. So that's why I'm running, and throw it open to questions.
What can we do?
Yeah, Chuck, what can we do as a group here?
Sign up Charlie Angus's campaign team. First on the ballot, first in your heart. I should give out some cards while we're at it.
Yes, please do.
Pass the paper.
The LEAP Manifesto? My position on the LEAP Manifesto is it's the beginning of a conversation. It's not the end of the conversation. Because we don't get to environmental justice without economic justice, so we have to bring rural Canada and we have to bring blue-collar Canada to the table. So let's start that conversation.
You could say that's a conversation.
What does that really mean? Well, what does it mean? It's like environmentalists and blue-collar people have to speak to each other. It's not happening. So we can make any number of demands. It's not going to bring environmental justice. Not when so many regions are falling behind. But if you talk to blue-collar workers, and I talk to them all the time, they have enormous ideas about change. So this is why, to me, it's the beginning of a conversation. But it's not the end of the conversation, you know? The group that started LEAP, that's great. But now let's start to bring in, to make this happen. I want to have more.
For the party, though, I mean, it's just for the last convention,
the two camps, I find that interesting because I hear that in the media say to me all the time how the NDP is the party of, you know, LEAP is breaking you guys apart over environment and jobs. It's like the issue of finding the solution. The balance between environment and jobs is not an NDP issue. It's the issue of our nation. It's the issue of our planet. The big difference with us is we're the only party that represents pit truck drivers in Fort Mac and bike couriers in downtown Toronto. I think we have an enormous opportunity to have. That's why I say the conversation starts in the NDP. We're the natural place for that because we understand and our constituencies have historically been that push and pull tension between environment and dreamers and what does the future world look like and the practicalities of people. The other parties aren't doing that. And we're not having that conversation anywhere else in Canada right now. I'm reading this book called The Great Derangement. It's fascinating. It's about just the incredible disconnect in the world about climate change. And I mean, nowhere is the Great Derangement more real than in Canadian media. I mean, talking about climate change in the Canadian media, you're immediately being seen as pro-Alberta or anti-Alberta or crazy or hysterical or reactionary. I'm looking at the Notley government, they're putting record investments in renewables. I'd say if I was in the federal government, I'd be working with them and say, let's do that. Oil sands workers are holding press conferences saying, where's the plan for transition? And that's not being talked about. So there is a derangement in Canada where at the national level, we're not talking about this. So our party is the one to say, let's do it.
I might just be imagining this, but I imagine that Carolyn Bennett has good intentions. But I think she's subverted by the bureaucracy quite a bit. What is
I have enormous respect for Carolyn, and her heart's in the right place. But I'm not throwing the bureaucracy under the bus for this government. This is about political will. This is about political will. Jody Wilson-Raybould, the first Indigenous Justice Minister ever, has lawyers in court fighting survivors of St. Anne's Residential School. Yes. Over the fact that they suppressed thousands of pages of police evidence of the torture of children. Jody Wilson-Raybould and Carolyn Bennett have lawyers fighting Cindy Blackstock at the Human Rights Tribunal, and they took the position that the federal government cannot be held accountable to the Human Rights Tribunal. So this is my view on politics. Nice people do bad things. This is political will. If the Prime Minister of the country isn't going to make this happen, then there's no difference between what happened under Paul Martin and Jean Chrétien. And I always say when I talk about Children of the Broken Treaty, don't blame Stephen Harper. Don't blame Stephen Harper. Don't blame Stephen Harper. He was just one of a long line of white dudes that have carried on the same policies, right? And it's like, oh, you know, the new government's not Stephen Harper, so things are better. Well, no, they're not. They're just nicer in how they do it, but it's still happening. So, yeah, I think Carolyn's great, but until, like, political will change the bureaucracy. And I haven't seen that political will to stand up and say we're going to do it. And that's why we have to push harder on this.
I worked many years for the minority society, and I always was very disappointed when my party came down on criminal justice issues. I just wondered, what's your position? I mean, our liberals aren't actually too bad on them, but I just wondered, you know, we have a guards union. I kind of actually don't live in this right now. I'm over in Cambridge. The guards union is kind of big there. Maybe they don't really capture
what I believe
is the
NDP spirit.
So I'm wondering what your view is on criminal justice policy.
The
big question, or you want to break it down into one part about it?
Well, it's a huge question. I think number one, if we put dollars into prevention, we're not going to have people in the system as much. And
they are in the system. What do we do with those guys?
Well,
most of them are guys, but you come down to, you know, a lot of women's groups who support the NDP want to lock up life and people who their lives for Mr. Park. And, you know, a longer sentence. It doesn't seem to matter whether left or right. It can often come down to longer sentences as an answer to just about everything.
Well, I mean, I'm a mix. I think we have to find ways of supporting people who are making the transition. It's not happening in the group home, like, the halfway houses. It's, you know, people, if you're going to transition people back into society, you have to have that support. We have to do prevention so that we keep people out of the system as much as possible. But, I mean, on the other hand, I think our sexual assault cases, I mean, it's a travesty what happens. Where, you know, I mean, I look at the Gomeshi case, and that's just the tip of the iceberg of, you know, the women, the whacking the witness for women in sexual assault. I mean, nobody whacks the witness in a robbery case. So, you know, I don't think it's black and white. I think we have to have a bit of a balance. And I certainly think in sexual assault cases, there needs to be some rebalance more for the victims, because I think the system's not working for them. For people in prison, I'd give them support so that they can make the transition. That would be what I would do.
Got a question.
Okay.
Good question. One over here and one over there. To me, the greatest injustice in the world today is that eight guys have as much wealth as 50% of the world's mm-hmm. population. We got two guys in Canada that have as much as maybe 40% yeah. of us have. And I've let Lloyd Longfield know that he's lost my vote for bailing out Bombardier for their dreadful management practices. To me, in the good old days, the government's role was to regulate big business and keep them on the straight and narrow. And now that doesn't happen so much. Big business runs everything and is left basically to regulate themselves. So I'm wondering what the NDP is going to do about that situation, starting to tax those super rich guys in a meaningful way.
Well, I think it's all about fairness. And I know people who are just getting by on the poverty line, and if they get an overpayment on their EI or their disability, man, they will claw back every dime. They will destroy that family to get every penny that's owed to them. I know young students who get audited year after year after year as though they're some kind of tax haven. And, oh, sorry, the people who are in the tax havens, we don't go after, and we cut deals with them, I'd get every dime of that back. For Bombardier, they lose $900 million, they beg a billion, they give themselves, five guys give themselves $32 million. That's our money. I'd claw every dime of that back. Every federal dollar that goes into a corporation, there's going to be no bonuses for the CEOs out of our money. Everyone else is expected to work for taxpayers' money. They live off taxpayers' money. Why shouldn't they? But I don't have a problem. I don't have a problem investing in corporations if they're going to create jobs. But I would insist on a job pledge. Number one, GM. We bailed them out. Workers took massive cuts. They lost pension benefits. As soon as they were back making money, look at Cammy down the road. That is the most efficient manufacturing, auto manufacturing plant in North America. They're making workers work 6 days a week, mandatory overtime. They're burning through the human capital, their workforce, to make profit. And they're shipping the jobs to Mexico. You get money from the Canadian government, you do jobs in Canada. I'm sorry. Bombardier, same thing. The amount of contracts Bombardier gets, and they're shipping the streetcars and subways to Mexico and elsewhere, it's our money. And you will never see the Liberal government stand up to that. What? Yeah. So, and in terms of fairness in the tax code, there used to be all manner of things that were covered through company benefits. Say dental, right? So families got covered, you know, like these were investments that companies were expected to make. Well, they've cut themselves loose from all this. And people are not getting the basic benefits that at least would have been covered under unions before. So I think it's perfectly fair. And again, I'm not a hard guy on this. I'm not ideological about taxes. It's all about fairness. You guys are making a whack ton more money because you're no longer paying things that used to be considered part of your business costs. Well, that's now being borne by society. So maybe we'll just have to tweak the tax code to return some of that fairness so that we can start cover off some of these costs, because otherwise people are falling further and further behind. So yeah, tax tools are enormous levers to bring to establish some kind of rules. And as far as regulation goes, well, self-regulation, how well is that working for us? It's, you know, it's not working very well.
Charlie, I did have a question for Bruce on his way in. And I think he'll probably email it to you, but he asked me to ask him as well. Do you believe that our various acts and various treaties connected to Indigenous people in Canada can be reformed, or do we need to start?
Well, I don't know how you reform a treaty. I mean, a treaty was an agreement, right? And so on Treaty 9, I don't know the other treaties as well, but Treaty 9, the oral agreement was that the land would be shared. What was written was completely different, but you were talking to an oral culture. And so the treaty is an understanding that we're going to do this together. And I think what you need is you need the federal government to live up, and the province to live up to its side of the bargain, because it hasn't done it up till now. And there's an assumption that these things will just disappear, but it's not all that long ago. I mean, Teresa Spence Natawapis got her grandfather signed the treaty. Stan Lutet, who was the grand chief that was a great mentor to me, his grandfather signed the treaty. So this isn't ancient history, you know, and my grandfather came to this country to work in the big gold mines that were discovered on treaty land. So that's not all that long ago. That's within two generations. So this is an ancient history. This is present history, and these are obligations. So, but I think the way we need to look at it, and I don't know if anyone knows how all the treaty stuff works itself out. But what I do know is that our primary relationship in this country is the relationship between the people who were here and the people who settled here. And 150 years from now, that will still be the primary relationship. So we can either have a positive relationship or a dysfunctional relationship. But if we start working together, we're going to start to find things change for the better. And that should be how we look at dealing with this. Let's start this conversation. Let's start building. And I've seen it all across the country. At the grassroots level, I think people are understanding and learning, and things have moved dramatically, even in the last 12 years, what's happening on the ground. But the federal government and the province cannot be impediments to that. They need to be strong partners, and you're going to see transformation.
Okay, just related to that, that's my question. I was wondering, can you give us an update? We've got a tremendously political literature. literate culture. And I don't think I need to give any background. Can you give us an update on where we are with the Right to Fire? Where does that stand?
Well, Ring of Fire is a massive chromite deposit in the St. James Bay lowlands, and it's in the midst of probably four of the poorest communities in North America, Martin Falls, Webequay, Escandaga. There's been a couple of, there's been a lot of talk about the development. Nothing's really happened yet. There's a new agreement with Martin Falls and one of the First Nations. I don't have an issue with mining if it's done with the involvement of the communities, if it's done so that we're starting to put, if we're going to put hydro to a mine, you put hydro to the community. You're going to build a road to the mine, then you say to the community, do you want the road, do you want access? Because the crushing levels of poverty from isolation are destroying traditional ways of life. So the people should have a say in that. They should be part of that. They should have an opportunity to participate, and they should then be able to get their young people educated and to do whatever. So that partnership has to happen. What the provincial Liberals are interested, I think, in is having there's been floating ideas of a railway and a Chinese government being involved, and man, leave it in the ground. Like, if we're going to ship raw unprocessed materials to China, like, again, this is the direction that you see the Liberal government going with, opening up more investment in the oil sands to Chinese state corporations. It's like, if we're going to have resource development, it has to be sustainable. There has to be strong environmental regulations. There has to be indigenous consent and support. And there has to be a larger benefit to us to do this, as opposed to just shipping it raw anywhere. So
there's a young indigenous man, Darren Thomas, who lives in Kitchener Waterloo. Young, he's 50 or 60, young compared to me, who's a part of the indigenous negotiating team that sits with the Ring of Fire.
Okay.
So he's a fabulous person if locally we want to increase our awareness. And if he's not up there, that is right in that consent-free, prior informed consent body.
Yeah.
Haudenosaunee.
And you know, on the ground, this is what's happening in mining country on the ground now. The issue of consent and the issue of First Nation involvement, mining companies get this. Like, they're not moving into territories now, in Ontario region especially, without that involvement at the grassroots. So they're getting it. What's not getting it is the government.
Do you have any other questions or concerns? Yes, right over here.
Yeah, I'm just kind of wondering, what is your kind of plan? I noticed that in the last election, the Liberals really went after the youth vote. And how do you aspire to really reach that?
Well, I think the big issue that we need to be talking about, again, is what's facing this youth generation in terms of massive levels of student debt and no certainty in economic future. That is, I think, really sucking the life out of an incredibly creative generation. The ability to make choices, the ability to plan a future when you're on endless short-term work contracts. We have to move towards free tuition. Public education used to be grade 10. No, grade 8. Then it was grade 10. Then it was grade 12. Nobody will look at you without a master's now. We need to move towards that. But I say that as a leadership candidate and saying move towards it, because I'm not going to say I'm going to guarantee that we're going to do it right away, because it's actually complicated in the negotiations involved. But these are principles that we need to start pushing towards to get that level of debt down. It is insane that we would burden people into their 40s with $60,000 worth of school debt. That's the drag to our economy is enormous. And then how do we start dealing with a completely changed work environment? There are more and more young people are going to are going to be very entrepreneurial because they're going to be doing a whole manner of things. So we need to use the tax tools to encourage, to be able to start up small businesses, to be able to do this contract work. For example, a real simple thing is, thanks to the brilliance of Brian Mulrooney, who downloaded all the tax responsibilities through the GST from big corporations, and then said that all manner of people are now contractors, people who do almost any kind of work have to collect the HST at $30,000. So $30,000, you become a tax collector for the federal government. It's an enormous burden. So you've got people who are just getting by. Maybe you've lost your job. Maybe you're thinking, no, I'm going to try and do this thing on the side. At $29,000, you're not having to be the tax collector for the federal government. At $30,000, you are. It's actually a huge disincentive for people who are starting out. So why don't we raise that to, say, $47,000 or $50,000 to say, get yourself your contract business set up. Get started. Because what the federal government's making off the HST at that level is not much anyways, but allow people to start creating the home-based businesses, the new ideas. So these are simple things, but it's never the bottom line on the HST has never been changed because it's not on anybody politician's radar because they don't tend to hang out with people who are making $29,000 a year. I personally know a lot of people making $29,000 a year, and so I see it, and it's like, this is an obvious change. Simple change would open doors for people that are otherwise closed.
Just one other thing. Yeah. I belong to a group that are trying to get oral health under OHIP.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think there's any chance we'll ever do it?
It's something I'm thinking about more and more. It's huge.
It's huge, and you have a huge lobby against it with the dental profession. But when you stop and think about it, OHIP covers the whole body except your mouth.
Yeah, yeah.
And seniors and people struggling to feed their kids can't afford to go to a dentist.
Yeah, I know.
So then we burden the emergency service.
Yeah.
They say.
It is. It's something like our first priority in terms of is pharmacare.
Mm-hmm.
We need to establish a national pharmacare system because it will lower costs and it will save lives. But the issue of dental is a big thing, and we need to start talking about that and starting to put it on the table because
we have a couple of associations.
Okay.
One called OOHA, Ontario Oral Health Association, and I think they've been going for about 10 years, and they're really starting to expand.
Yeah.
But we'll keep working at it.
Well, you know, we were dealing with a young woman the other day who had an accident and lost her front teeth.
Mm-hmm.
Well, nobody's going to hire her. She knows that.
Mm-hmm.
She's a young woman. You want to go in and work in a professional job and you don't have front teeth, but you're going to, what, it's going to cost her $5,000 to get them fixed? She doesn't have that. Like,
exactly.
These may not seem big things in Ottawa, but they're, or Queen's Park, but they're big things that are impeding people's ability.
Especially when our incomes are dropped.
Yeah, and you know, when I had a senior who couldn't eat because they didn't have debt, they couldn't afford their dentures, and I had to go to, you know, the Lions Club or, like, you know, you shouldn't have to be begging charity to get people dignity, and that's more and more we're starting to find that we're having to rely on service clubs and charities to do things that people should be able to access. So we. I don't have a simple solution to it yet, but it is something that my team's actually been talking about a lot.
Right.
Yeah.
The Canadian workforce has been begging for people with skills. How can the federal government encourage the skills instead of importing them? Why can't we promote more on our national level instead of going overseas and say, we need this, this, and this, and they come over and they have a fantastic job? This really bothers me because I'm in a situation where I can see people that are willing to work, but the minute they go out and work, they, like you said before, they remove that money they've made extra to what they're allowed to.
Yeah.
How can we encourage these people to get involved
to go to college.
In a college situation instead of, I'm not knocking university because I'm new university too, but in the meantime, we need to push college more because we need trade, we need professional trades that we don't have here.
That's a really good point. In the New Democratic Party in Nova Scotia is pushing for free college tuition, which I think is an excellent idea to get more people involved in the trades. But again, if we're going to do corporate tax breaks, I'm going to do corporate tax breaks for those who are willing to invest in training, because it does cost to invest, and companies don't want to invest. And so you end up with a workforce that gets older and older and older, and you're not training up people to replace them. So rather than doing this classic liberal conservative across-the-board tax cuts to corporations who then just ship the money off to the Cayman Islands or give it to their CEOs, let's say you want to invest in training up a workforce, we'll be your partner, because that will create an incentive to have people who have skills. Now, I also don't have a problem bringing in skilled workers to become part of the Canadian society. We have real opportunities right now. Like just down the road in Waterloo, you have this incredible innovation hub.
Yes.
And in that innovation hub, you do get a huge bang for the buck by bringing in people who have those kind of skills, who can set up work, and then other people get trained. So I think if there's areas where we can use immigration policy to drive incentive, to drive work, then again, it's about doing smart, making smart choices to make sure that everything that we're doing is about the benefit to Canada, the benefit to our economy, and getting more and more people part of the economy, to me, is what's going to create a more just society.
Yeah. How do you keep those people in Canada? Living next to Waterloo is tremendous to see what they're doing, producing in the way of all sorts of things, starting up little companies. But when they get going well, they sell other movies.
I know. That is one of the hard things. But, right now with Mr. Trump's heavy anti-immigration, there's actually an opportunity for a bunch of people who don't want to be in Silicon Valley anymore and want to come here. So, but, well, anyways, it looks like things are starting to settle down. So maybe we'll just I'll thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
And once again, that was Charlie Angus, MP for Timmins, James Bay, and the federal NDP leadership candidate. You can learn more about his platform at charlieangusndp.ca, and if that wasn't enough Charlie Angus for you, you can hear an exclusive interview with him tomorrow at 5 p.m. on Open Sources Guelph on CFRU 93.3 FM or CFRU.ca. And that's all for this week's edition of the Guelph Politicast. The music for the Guelph Politicast comes from KPM Classics. It's Sid Dale. The host for the Guelph Politicast is Podbean. Go to guelphpoliticast.podbean.com to listen to past episodes, and while you're there, you can also listen to Open Sources Guelph. If you missed last Thursday's episode on CFRU, you can download it via the Politicast channel on Podbean. You can get in touch with me by email at adamadonaldson@gmail.com. Reach me through Twitter at adamadonaldson. There's a Guelph Politico Facebook page at facebook.com/politicoguelph. And of course, if you can, please donate to the Guelph Politico Patreon at patreon.com/guelphpolitico. If you like locally sourced independent media in the city of Guelph, please consider donating. For all the latest local political news, check out guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca, where we will have a new episode of the Guelph Politicast for you shortly. And until then, see you next time.